My name is Heidi, in case I haven't met you yet, and I am here with you today, continuing in our series called Imago Dei, When Doctrine Meets Our Hearts. So I would like to put that message title in the kind of language that somebody with purple hair and a piercing in their face, like how they might say it, just to bring it down. It's a little less fancy, right? Maybe it'll help you too. So Imago Dei means image of God. And then when doctrine meets our hearts means that when we know that we were created in God's image and we really come to know his intimate, abundant love in a really personal way, it begins to really, truly transform us. We go beyond thinking about God's love and talking about it and maybe reading about it, and it begins to really transform us and heal us. So this morning I want to talk about how his love heals us from perfectionism. I don't know if we have any fellow perfectionists in the house. And also how it heals us from striving to meet impossible standards in order to feel worthy of love, worthy of approval. And so I have to admit that I am a recovering perfectionist. And maybe you can relate to this, that I think the holiday season really seems to lure us into this idea of the perfect holiday gathering, like the perfect Thanksgiving where the whole meal just comes out perfectly and none of your family members are trying to strangle each other. That's not a real thing where I come from, but or the perfect holiday Christmas gathering that really could only happen on the set of a cheesy Hallmark Christmas movie. Like, we envision our family photo looking like this. So sweet and angelic, but in reality, it looks more like this sometimes. We imagine our holiday feast looking like a Martha Stewart masterpiece. Glorious. But then it really just turns out more like this. Fido, get in there. Or like this gentleman's description of Thanksgiving on Twitter. It's like the lottery, except it's my Thanksgiving table, wondering who will get the stuffing with my wife's hair in it. Yikes, just keeping it real on Twitter there. So my favorite part of Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner is the sweet potato casserole. Any other sweet potato casserole fans? Okay, again, the husband has to say yes. Okay, good. And so, in the spirit of full disclosure, by the time that I have blended together the sweet potatoes with two sticks of butter and a cup of brown sugar and pecans and at least twice as many marshmallows as the recipe calls for, once this masterpiece has been so finely crafted, what started out as sweet potatoes cannot even be identified as a vegetable. They no longer share the same DNA, totally unrecognizable. So this, my friends, is the buttery, sugary, marshmallowy perfection that I have just described to you. And so because this is my favorite part of any family holiday gathering, I take on the responsibility of making my beloved sweet potato casserole. And I gotta tell you, it's really not in the spirit of like being a blessing to my family. No. Because we're in church, I'm gonna be really honest before you and the Lord and say that I make the sweet potato casserole to make sure that it is everything that I have dreamed it would be during the previous 10 months of sweet potato casserole detox. Now, the detox period is those 10 months when there is no Thanksgiving and there's no birth of our Savior that would warrant vegetables covered in marshmallows. So for 10 months, white knuckling it, just making it through, but then Christmas comes. And so at our last Christmas gathering at my grandma's house, Grandma Mary, we call her Grandma Mary, Grandma Mary is 96 years old, and so here I am at Grandma Mary's house, and I lovingly blended together the sweet potatoes and the brown sugar and the 14 sticks of butter and the pecans and the marshmallows and the more marshmallows and then some more marshmallows on top of that, and then I baked it until all the ingredients just melded together and the marshmallows turned that beautiful light golden brown that you see there. But then I got greedy. And I thought, I can achieve another level of sweet potato perfection if I just brown the marshmallows a little bit more. So I put it back in. And then I got distracted. And in what seemed like minutes, I mean seconds maybe, my sweet potato-y, marshmallow-y masterpiece went up in actual flames. Right there in Grandma Mary's house, her oven was on fire. But really, more importantly, the marshmallows, my marshmallow masterpiece was engulfed in a butter-fueled blaze. So I envisioned holiday perfection, but this was my reality. That is an actual photograph. My mom put it on the Christmas feast table, just I think like in memoriam of what could have been. So that's an actual photo. So thankfully, my grand visions and efforts don't always end up in a fiery blaze, but I do have to say that more often than not, I have found myself trying to live up to an impossible standard in various areas of my life. And sometimes I create that standard for myself, and sometimes other people have created that standard for me. I think that we begin comparing ourselves to others when we're really young. And it's really easy to just kind of start believing the lie that we just don't measure up. Maybe you can relate to this, maybe like me in school, maybe you were, you know, never quite in with the cool kids. Or maybe you just really also weren't athletic enough to be one of the athletes. And maybe your grades were okay, but you weren't really like one of the smart kids. And you were funny, but you weren't like really the funny kid. And so maybe like me, you compared yourself to your friends, to the other kids in your class, and you just kind of felt like you never really measured up. Or maybe you even had a parent or a family member that straight up told you that you just weren't good enough. I contributed to a book called Epiphanies recently, and just about a week ago, I got to hear one of my co-authors read her essay in the book. Beth wrote an essay called B is for Backwards, and in it, she tells about the messiness of her grief when her mother died. During the week of her mom's funeral, she found herself in her mother's home among her jewelry and among her clothes, but knowing that she would never see her mom here on this earth again. And as the grief was just kind of hitting her in waves the way that it does, she was reflecting on her relationship with her mom, and this is what she said. My mother had a way of looking me up and down without looking me in the face that was both irritating and crushing. I wasn't matched enough. I wasn't polished enough. I wasn't her enough. I wasn't enough. Maybe you can relate to that feeling of just feeling crushed by the disapproval of your mom or your dad or of that sibling that you always looked up to. Just being you was never enough, and that just felt soul crushing. You know, and then we eventually move away from home and we're done with all those cliques and trying to fit in high school. But then we get out into the world and this comparison game and this not good enoughness just kind of starts to show up in different ways. Like sometimes we end up working for bosses or serving under leaders where it just seems like they're never happy, no matter how many extra hours we put in or how many projects we take on or just how hard we try to really do our very best. It just seems like there's always something to find fault with, something that's just not quite good enough, always something to criticize. And then lots of us in our downtime, we spend our time on social media, which magnifies our idea of what perfection should be, what we should be. It sets up this system where we really can't help but compare our ordinary, everyday lives to other people's highlight reels, their epic vacation, their big opportunity or promotion that they just got, the marathon that they just ran, their perfect family photo, or their filtered, face-tuned selfies. Now, if you're under like 25, let me fill you in. Facetune is like the new Photoshop, and you can do it right on your phone. You can just like Photoshop your face and whiten your teeth. So all the selfies these days on social media are kind of face-tuned, which sets up that level of perfection that is just really not realistic to live up to. And it's really tricky because our sense of who we are and whether we are worthy of love is developed largely by what others mirror back to us. And this especially happens when we're really young, like before the age of 5, we develop a sense of whether we are loved and if the world is a safe place based on how our caregivers respond to us. But here's the deal. As adults, when we decide whether we are good enough or worthy of love based on what others in this broken world mirror back to us, that is a really flawed system. Like if I take what you think of me and I use that to decide if I am good enough or if I'm worthy of approval, that's a really broken and flawed system. So if we can see that this system of finding our worth in striving for perfection or in what other people think of us, if we can see that that's flawed, then what is the truth? What's the truth about where our worthiness of love and approval really comes from? Well, I want to read a psalm to you. And if what I have been sharing has been resonating with you, I want to invite you to just take a deep breath right now and invite God into this moment with you, just you and Him, and just kind of open your heart and your mind to this truth that I'm about to read over you, because what I'm about to read is what the Bible says that God thinks of you. His thoughts are precious and so loving about you. So just let these words kind of wash over you, settle into your heart and mind. As you hear this, you can close your eyes if you want to. You can even make this into kind of a prayer. Psalm 139 says, "You made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous, how well I know it. You watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the darkness of the womb. You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. How precious are your thoughts about me, O God. They cannot be numbered. I can't even count them. They outnumber the grains of sand." God made us perfectly, and His loving thoughts about us cannot even be counted. But then we enter this broken world and we forget how loved we are, and we look for our worth outside of how much He loves us, and we think that we have to earn love and we have to earn approval, and we forget about that intimate, perfect love that He has for us, and we feel separated from Him. But check out what the Bible has to say about that in Galatians 4. And I added one little parenthetical statement just to kind of help us get some clarity. It says, God sent his son so that he might redeem those of us who have been kidnapped by the law. And the law means a standard of perfection that we can't attain. We have been set free to experience our rightful heritage. You can tell for sure that you are now fully adopted as his own children because God sent the Spirit of his Son into our lives crying out, Papa, Father. Doesn't that privilege of intimate conversation with God make it plain that you are not a slave, but a child? Earlier, before you knew God personally, you were enslaved to so-called gods that had nothing of the divine about them. But now that you know the real God, or rather, since God knows you, how can you possibly subject yourselves again to those tin gods? You guys, every time we look for our worthiness of being loved or approved in someone else's, you know, in someone else's eyes or in an accomplishment, we make that person or thing a tin god. And as this passage says, we are enslaved to so-called gods that have nothing divine about them. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to spend my life trying to please a tin god. I don't want anyone else in the God seat of my life except the God that we just read about that loves me so, so much. So if we know that God created us perfectly according to his plan, and we know that Jesus came to pay the price for all of our mistakes, all of our wandering away from him, and our looking for our identity outside of his love, and if we know that he considers us his kids, and that he chose us, and that he adopted us into his family, why do we choose to subject ourselves to tin gods? Why do we sometimes feel like we just don't measure up? Well, I certainly do not have all the answers, but I do want to share two reasons why, even though we have heard these truths, many of us have heard them many times, and even though we believe they are true, why those feelings of not enoughness still come up sometimes. And those two things are guilt and shame. So these are two words that seem similar, but really they have very different meanings. Both guilt and shame can lead us to feel that we're not measuring up to God's standards, to other people's standards, and even to our own standards that we've created. And if we understand what guilt and shame really are, then we can recognize them when they pop up, and we can actually use them to help us grow. So guilt is that definition, is that feeling you get when you did something wrong or when you perceive that you did something wrong. Guilt is the feeling you get when you did something wrong or when you perceive that you did something wrong. Another word for this that we hear sometimes in church is conviction. When I do something that I know is not God's best for me, or when I do something that harms someone else or myself, I feel convicted. I feel guilt. And I see guilt and conviction as a gift because it lets me know that my words, that my behavior are out of alignment with God's ways, and then that gives me an opportunity to course correct. For example, if Ryan and I were to have a disagreement and I were to communicate with him in some way that was sarcastic or kind of snarky, I mean, for a few seconds I'm going to have a few seconds of like, yeah, I told him, that's right. But then that's going to wear off. And underneath that is going to be some discomfort, some cringy feelings, just feeling uneasy. And I will slow down long enough and just not make excuses for myself. if I will slow down and observe that discomfort that I'm feeling, what I'll find is that I'm experiencing guilt or conviction for communicating in an unkind or an unloving way. So this is absolutely a gift, because without it, I might just carry on as though I hadn't been ugly to him, as though everything is fine, and as though he should just act like everything is fine, and that's kind of gross. Or we might sort of just give each other the cold shoulder for a while, and that's gross too. But the gift that these feelings of guilt or conviction bring is the awareness that I actually did something wrong and I can choose to course correct. I can choose to humble myself and acknowledge my unloving behavior. I can ask for forgiveness. In recovery, we call this making amends. We do this in step 9 of the 12 steps. And sometimes when we go to somebody to make amends, we will also ask if there's anything else that we can do to make it right, just in an effort to do what we can to bring reconciliation and bring restoration to the relationship. So, two things that we can remember about guilt are, first of all of our wrongs have already been paid for when Christ died on the cross. That was really the whole point. He's like the ultimate guilt eliminator. You know, he paid the debt that we could never pay so that we could have a relationship with God. He really took care of our guilt. And then second, when we wrong others, we can first ask God's forgiveness and we can receive it knowing that it's a gift he gladly gives us. And then we can choose to go to that other person that we've harmed or that we've wronged, and we can make it right. We can humbly own where we messed up, we can ask for forgiveness, and we can even ask if there's anything else that we can do to restore the relationship. So guilt really is a gift when we acknowledge it and we allow it to lead us to repentance and restoration in our relationship with God and others. So shame. While guilt is a signal that we may have done something wrong and need to course correct, shame is the deep feeling or sense that we are fundamentally flawed or bad or wrong. Shame may not even be tied to one specific behavior or event. It can actually be much more pervasive, taking over our whole sense of worth. I found this really helpful diagram on a site called Very Well Mind, and I think it does a great job showing us the difference between guilt and shame. So, guilt, feeling remorse or responsible for something you've done wrong or perceived you did wrong. Guilt relates to a specific action like making a mistake, committing an offense, or hurting someone, whether intentionally or unintentionally. Shame is feeling that you are bad, worthy of contempt, or inadequate as a person. Shame relates to our behavior or ourself, often in relation to other people's opinions and not necessarily about a specific behavior or event. Feeling that you are bad, worthy of contempt, or inadequate as a person, often in relation to other people's opinions. So remember what my friend Beth wrote. My mother had a way of looking me up and down without looking me in the face that was both irritating and crushing. I wasn't matched enough. I wasn't polished enough. I wasn't her enough. I wasn't enough. I wasn't her enough. I wasn't enough. That's the voice of shame. And then remember what I said earlier. As adults, when we decide whether we are good enough or worthy of love based on what others in this broken world are mirroring back to us, it's a flawed system. And that's because it opens the door for shame to creep in. So we have solutions for guilt, right? First of all, we have Jesus, the ultimate solution for all of our wrongdoings and mess-ups and guilt. And then two, we can choose to make amends, to own our harmful behavior with others and do our best to make it right. But what is the solution for this more pervasive thing called shame? What is the cure for shame? Well, I think the first part of the solution is what we've done here this morning, just bringing light to the darkness where those lies have been living. Whether they originated from a parent's criticism, like my friend Beth wrote about, or if they've crept in over a lifetime of comparing yourself to others and feeling like you fall short, just becoming aware of those lies is a really powerful first step. Lies really can't survive in the light of awareness and truth. Lies really thrive in the darkness when we don't want to look at them. But when we allow ourselves to look at them and shine the light of God's truth on them, they really can't survive and they definitely can't thrive. So God has really done his part to love us extravagantly and to show his love for us. And our part is to receive his love and to live in the truth, which is so much easier said than done. This really has to be intentional, because without being intentional about our thoughts, we will always drift back to comparison and striving. We have to be intentional about saying no to the lies of unworthiness and the compulsion to prove our worthiness through achieving and through being perfect. So here are a couple of really practical ways we can do that. Number one, we can observe the feelings of shame and speak truth to those lies. When we observe one of those lies popping up, we can just notice ourselves trying to meet an external standard to feel good enough. When we notice that, we have to speak truth to that lie. Remember the Bible verses I read earlier about how abundantly loving God's thoughts are about us. Those words really have the power to rewire our thoughts about ourselves and to heal our hearts where we have felt unworthy or unlovable. So I just want to encourage you to find one verse or passage and read it every day until you start to really believe it. Because think of how many times over how many years you've repeated those thoughts of unworthiness in your mind. Or some of you have had other people repeating those lies to you. So it's only logical that we would need to intentionally speak truth to ourselves instead. And we would need to repeat it and repeat it until our mind believes the truth instead of the lies. So just choose one verse or one passage that causes you to really feel and know that you are loved and accepted and approved, and then just intentionally meditate on it. One great place to start is Psalm 139, which is the one that I read to you guys earlier. And then second solution for shame is to get in a community of folks who are recovering from not enoughness. In the recovery community, our fancy word for this is called codependency. When we are codependent, we're dependent on other people to feel okay, to feel loved, to feel worthy, to feel at peace. When we're codependent, we've lost touch with our true selves, the way God created us to be, and we've lost touch with the truth that we are enough just because God created us perfectly and he says we are enough. As Joyce Meyer says, you and God are a majority. You don't need anybody else's vote. But when I'm thinking in a codependent way, I don't believe that. I believe that I need God and. I need God and somebody else's approval. I need God and a certain accomplishment or material thing or relationship. But when I'm grounded in the truths that we've been talking about today, I know that God and I are a majority, and I don't need anybody else's approval. I don't need anybody else's vote. So when we have these feelings of shame and being not good enough, it's really easy to think that we are the only ones that struggle with this, especially when everybody else seems to kind of have it together. But I just want to encourage you, if you are connecting with this, that there are thousands of people like me who are recovering from codependency or not enoughness. And I'll tell you, my experience has been that God has brought me so much healing through relationships with other people who are just a little bit farther down the road from me in their recovery, in their healing, because I find that he just really heals us in community, not so much in isolation, but in relationships and in community. Because like I said earlier, lies really can't flourish in the light of awareness and truth and a healthy community of people who are also healing and recovering from not enoughness. They help us to be more aware when we're believing lies. They help us to speak truth to those lies and to heal. You know, Ryan and I have been here in Boulder Creek for almost a year now. We started, we moved here in December of last year from Texas. Thank you. thanks, we're so glad to be here. Yes, welcome to the big trees. We love it. And another thing I love is, you know, I feel like hanging out with you guys a little bit for the past year. You know, I just feel like I can say, if you're looking for a place that is safe for you to experience more healing, I really feel like this is a safe place to get connected. One way that's pretty obvious to get where you could get connected to heal from the things that I'm talking about today is Celebrate Recovery. And they typically meet on Wednesday evenings. They're not meeting this week because of the holidays, but typically Wednesday evenings, you can find them here. And that's a great place to get connected. And then also in a men's group, in a women's group, I just appreciate that so much about this church, that the people have always seemed so authentic and genuine as I've spoken to you guys. You know, I think it's a safe place where we can just be honest about where we need healing, and then we can do that together, which is so much more powerful than trying to do it alone. So I want to invite the band to come back up, and we're just going to create a space for us to connect with God in a personal way through communion. So if you did not get a little communion cup, just raise your hand, and one will be, put your little paw up in the air, and somebody will bring one to you. And then when you get it, you can try to use your key or something to stab it open and get that little styrofoam thing out of there. I mean, it's impossible. I don't know. But, we've got some in the front, I think, that need some. Cheryl? We got a few. Thank you so much. So as you just prepare to take communion, I just want to remind you of a couple of things. First of all, that Jesus is our ultimate solution for our guilt. He's the ultimate solution for all of our mistakes and our selfishness and for every way that we have ever harmed ourselves or harmed someone else. His death on the cross wiped away all of our guilt, and his forgiveness really gives us a clean slate every single day. All we have to do is just accept his gift of forgiveness. And so if you have never done that, you can have that conversation with God right now, and you can accept that gift of his grace and his mercy and his forgiveness. And if you already have a relationship with God through Christ, you can just take this time and thank him for all that he's done for you. You can thank him for taking all of your guilt upon himself on the cross and washing it away. Thank him that because he created you perfectly, we know that all of those voices of shame that pop pop up sometimes, those are just lies, and that His word about His extravagant love for us is the truth. So just take the next couple of minutes and just spend a few moments with God, connecting with Him, talking to Him. It's just you and Him right now as you take communion. And just whenever you're ready, the band's going to just play for a little while and give you a little time. And whenever you're ready, you can just join the band in our last song.